everyone. Welcome to another mind-numbingly delicious episode of Figuratively Feasting. My name is James Gopp, and I'm here with my co-pilot and buddy, Mr. Simeon Mordecai Bittman.
Hello.
Today, we're going to be talking about one of our favorite fruits. That's right.
Absolutely.
Fruit, the tomato.
The fruit.
The fruit. We're going to talk about its origins, where the hell this thing came from, how one country decided to essentially build their culture around it, including their flag.
And maybe even more than one country.
Indeed. And is this thing poisonous? Is it edible? What's going on with it? Is it a fruit? Is it a vegetable? And then we're going to sort of round it out with some modern takes on some recipes that we've been working on that doesn't include your Nana's pasta sauce or salsa. So, Morty, you ready for this?
Morty. Sure am.
All right. I'm super excited. So why don't we kick it off and you take us down this incredible, crazy rabbit hole.
Okay. Imagine this. It's 700 AD. Or maybe it's 500 BC because I read that too. And
so much conflicting information, which is difficult nowadays.
I'm trying to set the picture. Close your eyes. Are your eyes closed?
So closed.
Take a deep breath. Okay, you're in regions of South America, specifically Peru, or what is now known as Peru. The forests are lush. It's humid. It's hot. It's perfect conditions for growing a certain special world-changing fruit, vegetable, whatever the heck that thing is. It's not red, though. It's orange, gold, as a matter of fact. D'oro, of gold in Italian. It's small. It's round. It looks kind of like a sun gold cherry tomato glistening in the morning sun with dew. A young boy out on a walk through the forest crests a hill and sees the gold glistening in a distance. And he thinks, what's that? He walks up to it. He smells the leaves, intoxicating, beautiful, wonderful smell. Takes it to his lips. Crunches in. It bursts.
Instantly dies.
Dies, yeah. Definitely does not die.
200 years later, another boy comes.
And so it goes forever. Does not die, enjoys, brings plant home to family and community. Everybody enjoys it. It then spends 1,000 years being prepared in various ways. The first of the tomato sauces, the first of the salsas prepared there in Peru, South America, and Central America, using, this was like pre-allium, so no garlic yet, but there were what they call garlic leaves. There was an herb called hoja santo.
Beautiful.
Yep.
Yeah. I'm sure people will correct us if that.
Yeah, yeah, right. Please. There were sunflower petals. There were popcorn leaves.
Popcorn leaves?
Yep.
What is that from? Like some variation of corn, obviously.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Like a popcorn flower.
Huh.
Corn flower.
Okay.
At least that's what it was called. Very similar to the microgreens you can buy sometimes from some purveyors.
Sure.
Remember those little
yellow
popcorn leaves? Yeah.
Yeah.
Imagine those chopped up into a salsa, or just chopped up with peppers, chili peppers, and other spices.
Interesting.
Really interesting. So, 1,000 years in South America and Central America, the tomato flourished, began being cultivated. And it wasn't until the 1500s, that means the 16th century, that conquistadors came through Central and South America and discovered this wonderful fruit plant thing.
So, but just briefly, I need to interrupt you here.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you imagine? I mean, like, what a crazy situation that must be. You know, obviously those types of people, the Spaniards, had this technology to build big, beautiful, strong ships that could rule the ocean, and they did for some time.
Yep.
But to then travel to some place, just essentially just traveling in a direction until you hit land, then you see some other people. I mean, what a whole different life. It's so disconnected from where we are. You come across these people that are so far behind you technologically.
Yep.
You know, their outfits that they're wearing, and it's so foreign. And then, but yet, in a way, you're finding this to model, I think they called it, right?
Yep.
Is the tomato.
Mm-hmm.
Then finding chocolate and finding all these other things that are completely not growing in Spain. Mm-hmm. That are so different. It's like a whole different world. But you feel like a god next to them. And I'm sure in a lot of ways they see you as a god because of your technology.
Hmm.
Insane. Yeah.
So
put
wild.
Yourself in that shit.
Yeah, imagine being the discoverer of a completely new ingredient, like a completely new food source.
Yeah, a completely new world.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many things outside of chocolate, outside of these tomatoes, outside of lots of things we have. Isn't it insane?
Yeah, it's totally freaking such a trip. And that was only, I mean, it's all relative, but that's only 500 years ago.
Yeah, so young. It's not that long ago.
Scaling, yeah, discovering new lands, finding new places that people had been in for a long time.
Yeah, built civilization then.
Yeah, so 1,000 years, basically, until tomato and all those other ingredients were discovered by other parts of the world, overseas. And the conquistadors were so intrigued by the flavor and the smell and the appearance of this vegetable that they sent seeds back on ships. And it ended up, as the story goes, in Europe, France, Italy, and then all regions spread out from there. And it all kind of happened around the same time, though, man, like 1500s. It came over. It was considered poisonous. A lot of what people had for reference was a small, similar-looking fruit vegetable thing known as the deadly nightshade. They considered it this deadly, poisonous, potentially poisonous thing. It looked similar. It smelled similar. Although the deadly nightshade, I believe, looked more like an eggplant. So in some cases, folks thought that it was some sort of eggplant, some form of eggplant.
And those plants still exist today. There's like a nightshade vine.
Yeah.
There's still the deadly nightshade that grows. You don't even know that it's happening until it starts to grow. And then like the vines are still sort of furry like that.
Yeah.
And it has this tomato-like, you know, this tomato appearance, which is insane.
Yeah.
Once you see it, and you could totally, I mean, it makes sense. Like, not having access to any internet or anything like that, how you put those things together, and you're like, holy shit, yeah, I'm not eating this. Right?
Yeah.
It'll kill you, because that stuff will kill you. Shut down your liver and everything else.
Yeah. Plus, you start working into people's fear, man, and stuff can spread really quickly.
Folklore, tales, rumors.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
We can sort of see possibly some case of that happening even to this day right now.
Regarding
COVID.
Oh, sure.
And the incredible amount of fear. And I'm not going to directly say overreaction about it, but definitely an incredibly intense response to it. Anyhow, we're not here to get into scary, weird stuff. We're here to get away from that, man.
Yeah.
We're here to escape that. We're here to be transported through space and time to other lands, traveling with this beautiful fruit vegetable thing known as the tomato. So anyways, I might get destroyed by some Italians, but as the story goes,
can't wait to hear this.
The tomato was in France first.
Wow. We should just redo this one.
It was, I should say, it may have entered France and Italy around a similar time, which was around 1500s. But the French began using it as an ingredient and were feeling that it was safe to cook with shortly before the Italians. Now, there was good reason why it was adopted. It was more than just the fact that it was delicious. It was even more than the fact that they needed food. The French Revolution was in full gear, full effect, and they needed, there was a lot of blood being shed.
Yeah.
They needed a color to represent the revolution, and the red of the tomato was perfect for that.
Yeah.
Also interesting to know, the color red denotes that the tomato was now red. It was not golden anymore. Right. Very interesting.
Right.
So the French were making delicious sauces. In fact, it became one of the mother sauces, the tomato sauce. And it was then said that it was picked up by the Italians. There was a family, the Medici family, that straddled France and Italy, both.
Yeah, they were like the first modern food purveyors. Catherine de Medici. However is the correct pronunciation. Yeah, that was a big deal. And actually, to this day, when I worked at a natural foods market, there was a company called de Medici, which we would get these high-end pastas from Italy and a whole different other like beautiful San Marzano tomatoes and things like that, which I'm sure we'll get into in a little bit. But
That's interesting, man.
It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, when I was at cooking school at the CIA in Hyde Park, one of the kitchens and restaurants there was called Caterina de Medici.
Oh,
and it was all Italian food.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's a pretty cool place. So there it is in Italy, or there it is in France. And it gets its way over to Italy and finally recognized as a food, where it had been being used as decoration for a long time. It had gotten its name by that point, pomodoro, which means golden apple.
Oh. It's interesting because in France, too, potatoes, pomme de terre, which is apple of the earth.
Yeah.
So it's interesting why there's such a strong association. And I wonder if that has to do with a biblical association, you know, with like Adam and
like
Eve.
Like Adam and Eve and the apple. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, in France, it was called the love apple as well and thought to be an aphrodisiac.
So what's also interesting about that, yes, and I've heard that a few times about it being an aphrodisiac. What's interesting about that is that France, with what you're saying, chose red, you know, sort of celebrated the tomato because it symbolized spilled blood.
Mm.
But then, you know, when Italy had gotten it and they call it pomodoro, it still translates to golden apple.
Yeah.
So somewhere along the way, I mean, so I think, you know, there's a lot of speculation, obviously, about what the first tomato looked like.
Yeah.
There's a lot of suggestions, even based off of some colonial.
We didn't have Instagram or phone cameras back then, did we?
I didn't even live like that. How does one live like that? I can't even imagine. I don't want to live there. I'm kidding. Oh, my God. Sign me up. So, but... but it's interesting because somewhere along the ways there must have been some sort of genetic mutation that then started to change.
Yeah.
When I worked on a farm many years ago, you could see these slight variations based off of pollinators. But based off of, you know, modern industrial agriculture, you want to have your specific sized. But really, what I noticed the most was in winter squash growing in the field. But, you know, when you're selling these things, people know what a butternut squash is. They know what an acorn squash is. They know what it looks like. That's what they want. And with a modern agricultural system, they want the exact size butternut squash. They can ship it. They know how much they're going to get for it, how much roughly one is a pound, all that kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
There are slight genetic mutations that happen. Huh. So I'm sure that's what happened with this, probably.
Hmm.
I mean, because then even look at, like, you know, heirloom tomatoes, or as the English call them, heritage tomatoes.
Huh.
There's all different kinds and with cross-pollination.
So you think it was likely an accident?
Probably, right? Huh. I mean, I would assume, you know, when you're sort of, you know, when you're selecting seeds to plant in your own garden, or even if you're foraging for stuff. I mean, a great example that I learned this firsthand was with something called autumn olive, which is an invasive species, also known as Russian olive. This big, beautiful shrub that has these beautiful leaves, but underneath them are very silver. They're like this incredibly shiny.
I've been seeing those everywhere. I'm waiting to see what's going to happen with those olives. Are they going to be usable? Can I brine them?
No, you wouldn't use them like that. They're more of like a sweet tannic sort of flavor. They are in the same family as olives, but they're the most one of the most beautiful wild foraged foods is it almost looks like when you get close to them, they have this chrome overspray on them. They're speckled. They're super delicious, you know, and a real common use for them is to cook them and turn them into a fruit leather. So but the reason I'm bringing it up in this case is that when they say, when you're collecting wild berries, or in this case, these wild autumn olives, as you go to each shrub, you taste them. If one shrub, you know, tastes good, keep collecting from that one. But there's a chance that there might be a shrub right next to it that's not as sweet or maybe even bitter.
Yeah.
But when you are trying to propagate something, you're going to collect those traits. Like you have this big, enormous tomato. You're like, oh my gosh, these are amazing. They're so sweet and they're massive. I'm going to make sure I save these seeds. You're not going to grow the seeds next to them.
Yeah.
You want these big things. And that's right. How it works over generations and generations. Huh. Who knows? That's maybe how it happened.
Yeah.
Maybe there was some combination of that and pollinators.
Huh.
So who knows? I mean, it's yeah. fascinating to see how something went from being essentially wild to then cultivated. And I'm sure the flavor, if we were able to somehow harness the flavor back from the Andes where they came from versus, I mean, today would be two different plants altogether, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry to interrupt you. Please continue.
Yeah, totally. I don't remember what I was talking about now. Thanks.
You're very welcome.
What are we talking about today? Tomatoes, right?
Tomatoes.
Is that what it is?
Tomats.
Tomatel.
Yeah.
So France, then they make their way to Italy, where they're also appreciated for their color, especially paired with basil, green, and fresh mozzarella, white, red, green, white, colors of the flag. So
why? Well, I mean, I'm going to interrupt you again. Why do the Italians take such a shine to the tomato? Like, what is that about? I mean, the fact that they literally built their flag around these three things, but it probably started, by the sounds of what you're saying, with the tomato. Like, and then they just loved basil. They loved mozzarella. So, like, what's the deal?
My guess is that it was just the final link between stuff they had already had happening. Like, they already had beautiful cheese. They already had the basil. They had olives, they had lots of different ingredients, and they were enjoying them all the time. Then the tomato comes along, it's savory, it's sweet, it's slightly salty, it has just like this huge flavor profile, and someone probably cooked that thing up and was like, this tastes so good, I want to put some cheese on it and some basil. And they ate that and they're like, that's it. You know, they're probably wanting to have an identity of some sort. They're always kind of this friction, this kind of stuff happening between Italy and France all these years. Mm. Who's better? Who's cooler? Who's got better food? Who's got better people? Who's got the better lifestyle? All this stuff. So they like grab it, hold on to it tight.
That's like an age-old debate as to who was the founding country of gastronomy, Italy or France.
Yeah, of course. And that's totally cool. I mean, let them duke it out, because if it makes them strive to make really good food, that then spreads to the rest of the world and inspires cuisines from all over the place,
sure, yeah.
Then by all means, go for it. So, yeah, Italy... first recipe recorded in 1781. It was a recipe called Pomodori alla Certosina by a Vincenzo Corrado. And it's basically a fish and anchovy stuffed tomato that's then fried, as the recipe says. I'm not sure what that means, because I don't think it was referring to like egg battered, breaded and then dipped in hot oil, but it could be. It could have just been like a lot of oil in a pan or something like that,
right.
And then served with more tomato sauce.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, okay. Well, that makes sense.
So you think about, like, even back then, the difference between French and Italian cooking, you know, the Italians are always saying how simple and sort of almost rustic it is, but how it highlights all the ingredients, and the French are, like, technique-based and all that stuff. The French had their classic tomato sauce, their mother sauce that was, like, veal stock, and a bunch of different steps and tons of different ingredients and cooked down for hours and hours and hours and skimmed and strained and all this stuff, different phases. The Italians boil that tomato, take off the skin, maybe take out the seeds, no big deal. Cook it a little bit longer, smash it up, put some garlic and salt in it, and finish it with basil. And there you go.
Wow. Yeah. That's interesting. And I'm curious about, like, you know, why, because there was such a sort of conflicting discussion about if this tomato was poisonous, was it edible, whatever, because, you know, there were also early specimens that made it into England, and they were really big into botany. A big study about plants.
Yeah.
And such beautiful greenhouses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they used to have dedicated gardens that were poisonous gardens, like poison, so that you would know you can't eat these things and this things, but they were beautiful specimens.
Wow.
And the nightshades were also in that. But they considered at that point in time tomatoes to be a non-edible plant, only ornamental or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
There were some people that tried to eat it, but everybody, there's like some accounts written down where they just lashed against the texture, the mushiness of it, mm-hmm. the sourness of it. And it's so funny to think about it, like, you know, because if you don't know,
yeah,
like acidity and how good that is in a dish, it can be a total turnoff.
Right. You know? Yeah. Totally. And yeah, it's spent basically in every part of the world when it finally. It hit Europe, and then it just spread from there. And it all kind of happened around the same time, which is 1500s, early 1500. It was considered an ornamental and poisonous for 200 years, if not longer.
Which is insane.
There are some regions of the world that, you know, according to some of the research I did, it was embraced as an ingredient earlier on, like Japan. It was like 1600s. In India, even around 1500, it was starting to get used in dals and different sauces and things, and as a chutney. It took that long for people to get around to being comfortable with it. And even then, they weren't totally comfortable with it. So they were wanting to cook it a lot. So a lot of the early recipes or discoveries of it would be to preserve it, so that it would be around in the winter, because it definitely tasted freaking good enough that they knew they were going to miss it in the coming season.
Sure.
But also, it was just like cooking it down. So sauce, catsup in North America, chutneys. It would be pickled, all these various things. There was like early recipes for all these things throughout the world.
Yeah, what I'd be curious about is knowing as to how it got to India. Do you have any clue on how it got there?
The Portuguese.
Interesting.
So I don't know a lot about how the Portuguese ended up in India or their influence or any of that kind of historical perspective. But I do know that it was the Portuguese who brought it there. And it was in the 1500s. And it was like immediately caught on in India because it's so hot there.
Yeah.
It was perfect for tomatoes. Tomatoes do like it hot, and they like it pretty dry too, as a matter of fact, right?
Exactly.
Too much water and they split, they can get more susceptible to blight, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So dry, maybe watered occasionally, but enough is exactly what they like.
Interesting. I wonder if, you know, because India was a colony of England, I wonder, you know, how much they sort of ruled the sea, if there were some influence of that as well.
Hmm.
You know,
yeah.
Because I know some of the research I did, you know, Italy being a colony of Spain, you know, sort of like a poor situation.
Italy and or India?
Italy.
Oh, Italy. Got it.
And so Italy was a colony of Spain, and, you know, they were sort of a relatively poor, you know, colony.
Yeah.
So I wonder with that type of stuff, you know, where it was kind of the situation, kind of like in the medieval times, kings that were responsible for feeding the peasants within their own castle used to feed them lobsters and things like this, because they were considered, lobsters were considered to be the cockroaches of the sea.
Yeah.
Just be like disgusting insects.
Uh-huh.
Lo and behold, here we are today. Lobsters are amazing, delicious, and expensive.
Well,
you know.
Yeah, I mean, definitely tomatoes grew abundantly in all of these regions that we're going to talk about today and that we've been talking about. So they became economical. They became easy to have around, and they were in abundance.
Yeah.
So they were cheap and good.
Yeah. Yeah, 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 exactly. So that's what I'm wondering about. Like, was it a type of thing where, because there was so much of it, they gave them to the colonies in, you know, Italy for Spain, and then in India when it was underneath English rule.
Hmm.
It was sort of something that was like just cheap or whatever. Who knows? They gave them sort of this questionable product because who cares?
Yeah.
You know, I really don't know, but that's fascinating that it traveled that far.
Yeah, right. I mean, maybe the Portuguese just came into to India, for example, and they knew they were going to be staying there for a while, a few years. And they're like, I'm going to want to eat tomatoes. So I'm going to bring me some seeds and some seedlings.
Sure.
And get planting.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the culture and the people there caught on, found it to be delicious, and started making dals, like these dishes with lentils that were tomato-based.
Yep.
And there's actually like a particular tomato sauce type dish that gets served over rice that's still used to this day.
Huh.
It's like a slong low cook with tamarind and spices. And it's like prepared very thin, almost like a thin soup called rasam.
Hmm.
Pretty interesting stuff. And there's this other one, tomato sar, which is sort of like a, well, it's described as a gravy. So I'd imagine it's sort of a thicker kind of sauce.
Okay.
Made with paste, a vatan paste, they call it, which is coconut and ginger spices. And then a little bit of sugar to offset some of the tang.
Interesting. Yeah, tamarind is a weird one. You know, like,
imagine that with tomato.
Yeah. But also even just tasting that first and being like, holy, like that's like super sour and funky and all different kinds of weird things. And super fibrous. You know, and then to like learning, I remember when I was in culinary school, we had to learn how to be able to work with that. And it's a process. Crazy.
Yeah.
Crazy thing. So.
Yeah. So it goes. Italy, France, back to Italy real quick. There was a very seminal cookbook published by Pellegrino Artusi. It was called La Scienza in Cucina e l'Arte di Mangiare Bene.
Mm.
The Science of Cooking and the Art of Eating Well.
Wow. Wow.
So in that book was the first documentation of tomato sauce. And this book was very quickly and highly regarded as a food Bible. So that pretty much set in stone tomato sauce from that point on. That's...
You gotta get a copy of that.
That's late 1800s, man.
Wow.
That's 120 years ago.
Yeah.
That's it.
That's crazy.
Not very long ago.
No. Considering. You know, like I heard something recently. I think it was a podcast with Joe Rogan and Mike Tyson. Was it maybe less than a week ago? We're talking about, and I have to fact check this. I haven't fact checked it. I mean, I hate to say this, but I think Mike Tyson is a fantastic fighter. I don't know about his, you know, historical references. I don't know how accurate he is with that. But he was talking about the Great Wall of China, 2,000 years to build, which is probably pretty close to being accurate. But you think about that in the lifespan of a human being, especially back then when they were building it. It's a very different lifespan than it is now.
Yeah.
It's a little bit shorter.
Shorter, yeah.
But crazy. So
like generations and generations and generations working on this wall.
And here we are talking about this cookbook that's 800 and whatever, 10 years old or something.
Mm-hmm.
That's insane.
Yeah.
So it's all, I mean, it goes to show you all how truly young we are as a species. And how little we know, and it's how important it is to question everything, because in the grand scheme of things, 800 years seems like a lot, but you know, there's things that are constantly being disproven
in
different ways, of different perspectives of looking at things.
Yeah, totally. That's the trip to think about. You know, it's like we may have discovered all of the ingredients that could possibly be cooked with on the planet. But maybe we haven't.
Yeah.
If you consider foraging and all the things out living in the forest, things that we are rediscovering now as food sources that were very, very long time ago in all kinds of parts of the world.
Yeah.
Various herbs and flowers and all kinds of other plants.
Yeah.
There's probably a lot out there that we could probably eat and gain a lot of nourishment from that we have no idea about.
No, and certainly 800 years from now, assuming there still is wild, forest out there.
Yeah.
I mean, we'll be in a completely different place. I mean, especially going back to tomatoes, you know, there's still a big discussion right now about, is it poisonous? Are plants of it, are parts of it poisonous?
Right.
The roots and
can
the,
you eat the leaves?
And, you know, there's a lot of discussion about that. And for a very long time, the leaves were considered to be completely toxic.
Right.
But they contain tomatine, which is a different chemical compound than what's found in potato plants. And we were talking about this in the last podcast, I feel like.
Or, solenoids.
Yeah. So it's a different thing.
Yeah.
So... yeah, I mean, here's the deal. You eat enough, if you drink enough water, you'll die because you flush your body of all of the nutrients and everything else that you have. I mean, you're basically clarifying it when you can't live in a sterile. Your body cannot live in that type of environment. You eat enough carrots, you'll get sick. You eat enough of anything, you're going to get sick. So there is a degree of toxins in everything we eat. You know, so with tomatoes, are they toxic? Well, depends on who you are. You know, there are some people that have autoimmune diseases, people that have problems with inflammatory issues in their joints. And typically that stems back to nightshades. Now, nightshades, what are in the nightshades family? Peppers, eggplants, tomatoes, potatoes. What else? What else am I missing? I feel like there's other things.
Did you say peppers?
Yep.
Yeah. I think that's it, man.
I think, yeah. So there's that, maybe some other things. But those have been proven to... you know, show signs of inflammatory...
You said eggplant.
Eggplant, tomatoes, peppers, potatoes, obviously tomatoes. Those types of things have shown to give some sort of, you know, inflammatory issues for folks.
Yeah.
Now, that's not everybody. Some people, if you realize you're having issues with that, your joints hurt, if you're eating a lot of tomatoes, and tomatoes are in so many things that we don't even know. I mean, there's tomato in barbecue sauce. There's tomatoes, obviously, in ketchup. There's tomatoes in pasta sauce. There's a lot of things. Pay attention to that kind of stuff. If your joints hurt, then maybe work on working those out of your system. But if you don't have those issues, these vegetables, fruits, vegetables, are very beneficial to our system.
Yeah.
So... yeah, I mean, like, you know, I've been screwing around with making stuff from, I mean, you can do, truth be told, the tomato leaves don't have a huge amount of flavor. I've tried to infuse them into vinegar, you know.
But what they do have is aroma.
They do. Yeah, they certainly do. So when you're picking them, or even you go to the grocery store and you look at your, you know, factory-produced tomatoes, those vines on there, you pick them up, you smell your fingers, there's a high amount of aroma.
Yeah.
Now, I've had some success by running them through a still. And usually with a still, what happens is you're not focusing on the flavor. It's more of the aroma.
So well, wait. Don't give up all of this shit or all of this stuff, because at the end, I want you to really like
let loose
on that stuff.
Don't worry. I'll get into that kind of stuff. But
okay.
The point is, like, right. This type of stuff is, there are some edible qualities. But just because they're edible doesn't mean, like, you need to be like, oh, hell yeah, I want to eat me a whole tomato leaf salad. You don't want that. I mean, it's not that good. It's, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah.
So it's kind of light. But,
yeah, right.
You know, so some of the stuff, I mean, I know you talked about a lot of things. And, you know, I do want to touch on some of the stuff that happened in America. You know, some of the stuff, the research that I came across, you know, was in the early 1700s, or probably around 1710, was actually the first documented sign of someone growing tomatoes. And those were in the Carolinas. And it's really interesting because when Spaniards came in, the conquistadors, they kind of owned that whole southern trade route down in that area. And that makes sense that they were the ones that sort of, you know, took the tomatoes and dispersed them. They had a, you know, sort of a home base in the Caribbean. And then ultimately the tomatoes came back to the homeland in Spain. But for many years, hundreds of years, they were in the Caribbean. And a lot of people had exposure to them. They were using them. They were cooking them. Now, you know, there's sort of speculation as to how the tomato landed in the Carolinas.
Yeah.
Was it because of its vicinity to Florida at that point, which was run by, you know, Spain, Spanish Florida? Or was it because of the trade route that was happening with the Caribbean? And not all, like, the enslaved folks, the enslaved people, but the majority of them were being controlled and sort of distributed through the English trade. They sort of owned that whole business. About 5% or so were from the Caribbean that were still underneath, you know, the Spanish control. So there is a thought that, you know, some slaves came through the trade, the enslaved people came through the trade, and landed in the Carolinas and started to edge, you know, kind of bring that food source with them and start cooking, which is pretty interesting to think about. Mm. So that
they
was
said happening. Is that as the story goes, it was slaves that brought barbecue to this country, right?
Well, that's to what actually south. Kind of the last sort of
barbacoa.
Barbacoa, as we touched on our last podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's so interesting. And I'm sure tomatoes were involved in that cuisine as well. Mm. You know? So
So North America.
Yeah.
So finally, it's like it goes all over the place. It's in India. It's been in China for a couple hundred years. It's been in Indonesia, even used as sort of a tomato sauce there, sambal tomat. Mm-hmm. In China, it's already been embraced, but considered ornamental pretty much mm-hmm. for a really long time mm-hmm. until it starts working its way into some classic dishes like beef with tomato or tomato and egg.
Yeah,
it's
right.
Yeah, and as I said already, it's in India. Then finally, I do believe it was a fateful, well, it was in North America, but considered a decor for a long time and poisonous.
Yeah.
And it took a special event, Jefferson, right?
So Thomas Jefferson, yeah, around 1780, he was in a trip over in Paris, France.
Yeah.
And that's where...
And he was all about France all the time.
Yeah, he was a huge farmer. I mean, he was a really big into seed collecting, storage. He had an amazing farm, Monticello. Mm-hmm. Him and George Washington, Mount Vernon, they had like one of the most prosperous, interesting farms that not only produced fruits and vegetables for trade and income, but also experimental stuff.
Yeah.
They were really interested in, I mean, specifically Jefferson was really interested in collecting seeds from all over the world, trying to grow them.
Yeah, and he had this big network of farmers, too, apparently, across the country. Mm-hmm. So if he collected or created some kind of seed that he found interesting, he'd mail it off to all these farmers.
Exactly.
And be like, hey, grow this and let me know what you think.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what happened with these seeds he had. And he mailed them to a guy named Robert Rutherford in Pennsylvania, who actually ended up planting the tomato seeds. Delicious. Loved them. Ate them. And he said, later on, he sort of wrote in his journal, and it became published, that over the course of around 20 years of him growing these tomatoes, he was only ever able to get approximately one other person, really, to try them.
Wow.
Because, again, it came from this idea that they were poisonous.
Poison. Yeah.
So this was fed in. So these, you know, this was the colonies, right? So what did they have to learn from was their forefathers, you know, the English.
Yeah.
And the English considered this plant to be highly, highly, you know, poisonous, toxic, whatever. You know, actually... you know, as I mentioned earlier, in the early 1700s, 1710 was the first time it was actually documented to be grown as a food crop. Hmm. And then we get into about 1764, and a woman wrote a cookbook. Well, she didn't write a cookbook. It was her own home cookbook was found in this manuscript that had been printed up for a recipe for a tomato sort of sauce that was used to dress on haddock. And she said it was, you know, in the style of Spain. So... even back
of
then,
Spain.
It was known that sort of hailed from Spain. So around 1764, kind of going back just a little bit earlier, was when it started to make it onto farmers' calendars to know when to be able to plant these things. So again, this is a crop that's very controversial. A lot of people, I mean, you could have one state that would say in Pennsylvania that would eat these tomatoes, and then you might have a neighboring state that says absolutely not. These things are toxic.
Yeah.
And even like as we get into today, even things like coffee, you know, some people, I love coffee. Some people tell you it'll kill you with the caffeine and everything
right.
else. And then you have some people that are selling coffee berry extract that are super high in antioxidants and cancer fighting and all this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, it's so interesting to me at this point in time in the world, we're still questioning these kinds of things. We don't really know what's good for us and what's bad for us.
Yeah. And there are a lot of theories there are a lot of ideas that it's Europe and well, it's really North Americans and us here who are considerably behind in our development of understanding what is good for us and what isn't and what kind of diet. So there's all these fad diets and all this extreme stuff we do to ourselves, you know, there are like other regions of the world that have been pretty settled in like what they've been cooking. They figured out moderation a long time ago and are sort of watching us like, wow, Guys are pretty lost, I must say.
What is that about, I wonder, right? I mean, it's like, where is it, you know, a lot of, I can't help but wonder if it's because, you know, considering we're talking about when tomato sauce was documented, the first case of tomato sauce.
Yeah.
I mean, you got to think about America being created in such a short period of time, what we've achieved in not even that long of a time. But then you look at some places over in Europe that have been around for several hundred years.
Yeah.
There's a stark difference there. And I think this country is built on, you know, these sort of rebels, these renegades that left England, came over here, did their own thing. And somewhere along the way, it was, I mean, just push, push, push. I think, you know, I mean, when I started my own business, I'm not going to mention any names or whatever, but when I started my own business, it was definitely with this idea that I was, you know, as we tend to do sometimes, you leave a job when you're unhappy, you're disgruntled, and you're driven. That is definitely a source. So if you're sort of excommunicated from your own country, then you're excommunicated from your own country, then there's some drive there. You're going to want to achieve, and you're going to want to
push. You're going to want to do everything different. Yeah. You might even want to, like, eat completely different.
Yeah.
You're like, I don't even want to eat like that anymore. I want to just figure out how to, like, nourish my own body and all my family in a way that has nothing to do with that place.
Absolutely right. Yeah, you want to become your own thing. I mean, what was this phrase there? The Puritans, the Lord gave me a heart to pray and hands to work, I think was their term. Huh. And so that means, like, they just busted their hump and prayed and had a vision in what it is they were doing. And, you know, as you can imagine, those generations handed down and handed down and handed down, you get into a position, you know, where we talked about last week, you know, the titans of industry and how hard they worked to create, innovate, create business, create industry.
Yeah.
You know, so we've achieved a lot, and I can't help but wonder if that also then trickles down to the rest of our way of thinking, where it's, you know, with these fads, these diet fads, we want to lose 20 pounds tomorrow.
Yeah.
And what does that mean? Well, you don't eat food, you don't drink water, and whatever. And it's not good for us. And we look at food less as a pleasurable experience and more, I think a lot of us actually look at it as less the pleasurable experience and more as a means to an end or whatever, you know, so we can have those really sweet Instagram pictures where we go in there and we Photoshop, we tuck our sides, we have those airbrushed abs and all that kind of stuff. It's really...
Yeah, it's crazy to think about. Yeah, interesting culture. And I mean, just... At the end of the day, we're a young culture. We're the youngest in the world.
Correct.
And we essentially were people from other parts of the world before who came here. So we don't really know what we're doing yet in a lot of ways, I would say. But definitely when it comes to food and cuisine. And then the story about being a melting pot kind of, I think it further... mutates it. So we end up having a culinary identity that can't even be identified as one particular thing, except to the outside world that makes fun of us for being like hamburgers and fries whatever.
Right.
But if you look at it, there's like just all it is a bunch of different regions that sort of specialize in different cuisine. You've got New England, you've got the South, you've got the West, you've got the Pacific Northwest, you know, and it's like, all sort of fragmented, but taking influence from other parts of the world.
Yeah.
And then immigrants, people who come into this country from other parts of the world and bring their cuisine that we freaking love. And so, like, who are we, man?
But the story, even going back to our, you know, conversation before, even last week's podcast, is everybody in the world is an immigrant.
Yeah.
They've all gone to different areas. And because they've been in certain areas again. So like what else? I mean, I felt like this is a bit controversial to say, but I sometimes think that the United States is just too big. It's just too big. It seems like you look at other countries in comparison to where we are. It's massive.
Yeah.
And like, you look at Europe, you look at the countries there, they're the size of some of our states, you know? And that's,
I mean, China's freaking big. China's huge. And they've, you know, and also like cuisine fluctuates a lot in different regions of China. But when we think of it, maybe we're just being stupid, but when we think of Chinese cuisine, not just the crappy, whatever Chinese,
Americanized
Chinese that we've come to basically be addicted to because it's so freaking delicious. But we think of like Chinese cuisine, we think of the entire country, and we see a lot of similarities, I suppose, in ingredients and technique throughout that huge freaking swath of land.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, obviously that is a big, you know, it's a big country for cuisine. But when I think of things like, you know, France and Italy, I mean, that is paramount. That's like a huge part of who they are.
And France is freaking tiny. And so is Italy. I mean, compared to North America or China.
Yeah, sure. So it's interesting to see all that kind of stuff. And again, going back to a conversation of how young we are, what is it going to be like, you know, 800 years from now? Is there going to be, you know, will, I have no clue. Like, what if this country decides
that it
wants to get broken up, and then all of a sudden it becomes, you know, this type of, this, you know, the country is this specific type of food. I don't know. It's crazy how things change.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Like, and there may not even be any, I don't know. I don't want to be dark or morbid or anything, but there's a chance that food could be getting produced in labs in the future. Yeah. I mean, there's definitely, they're looking at it. They're trying to figure out special lighting and all kinds of things. They're figuring out how to grow tomatoes not in soil, like without the need for soil.
Right. So like hydroponic or?
Like just using, in some cases it could be using water in that way, but just creating these super controlled, incredibly controlled situations, climates, controlled with light and humidity and all those things just being pumped in as needed with the water or whatever the growing medium is provided with the necessary minerals and nutrients to allow that thing to grow. And it being each plant being so carefully analyzed that like it can tell from moment to moment if it needs some more nitrogen right now and it'll like inject a little bit more into it. Does it need some more potassium right now? Like it'll inject that in a little bit. And just like keep doing it so that you end up with these perfect plants that actually nature could never provide, but that nature doesn't provide anymore.
Right. I mean, I wonder about those types of things, man. I mean, is that appropriate to play God? I understand. I see the value in it.
We're going out there right now.
Yeah. No, it's okay because, you know, we're getting into it because you're saying, oh, they're creating these things. But a lot of it's already like the groundwork has been laid for it. Back in the early 1980s, there was a company called Celgene. I think it had probably something to do with like California genetics.
Yeah.
That started getting to work on tomatoes. Of trying to create that was kind of like the first genetically modified piece of produce that hit mainstream. Again, people were very skeptical.
I remember that. There's still, it was being crossed with fish.
Yes.
And fish genes. What other stuff?
Some stuff, I believe it had to do with like pork genes as well, so that it grew faster and stronger. And the reason it was mixed with fish genetics was so that it could grow more into cold weather, because as we talked about earlier, it likes hot, dry stuff.
Yeah.
But specifically what they focused on was looking at the genetics and isolating the chemical or the compound that started to, like once tomato hit a certain maturity, it began to degrade.
Mm.
It started to get to be super mushy, dehydrated. And so what they were able to find is to get in there and rewire it, basically stop that gene from progressing to being mushy. And that was their whole thing. They went on many talk shows. They had a really great marketing campaign behind them, but these people were scientists.
Mm-hmm.
They had no clue. They had no clue about farming. Like they were growing these tomatoes in these huge batches down in Mexico, trucking them to Chicago, and they would show up in Chicago and they'd open up the back of the trailer truck and the tomatoes were spilled all over the place, mush. I mean, there were so many tales behind the scenes of these guys just didn't know how to do really anything when it came to food. They knew absolutely, they called themselves gene jockeys because they knew what they were doing there, and they had a good run. The tomato was called Flavor Saver, and that was the whole shtick, that you could pick it and it could sit in your countertop for 30 days and not degrade. That was the idea.
And so not you could taste like anything either.
Yeah.
It was a flavor saver because you saved on flavor because there was none in there.
Yeah, exactly. So it was a big, you know, a big funny thing in the media. People had lots to say. They wanted to know if it bounced like a ball and all this other stuff. And they had a run for about 12 years and, you know, with moderate success. And ultimately, they sold their business to Monsanto.
Yeah, man.
And the reason Monsanto was so interested in them was because they had all the patents on these tomatoes so that people could not replicate this specific version, this breed of tomato, this style of growing.
Dun, dun, dun. Yeah. Sorry, then, I just wanted to say that.
No, it's good. It feels good.
It felt good.
It's ominous. It's dark. And, you know, that's sort of the precursor to the modern day Monsanto. Back then, Calgene was really very clear. They were very transparent. I think that's what really worked with the public accepting it. You know, people were asking them, are these tomatoes clearly labeled? And they would say, absolutely. And like, all this whole thing. Now, Monsanto has fought DuPont, Monsanto, Nestle, lots of folks, the labeling. And as of 2012, I want to say it's like 93% or so. This is the study I was looking at. Of soybeans were all genetically modified, and 88%, I think, of corn was genetically modified, but not labeled.
Yeah, not labeled.
So, but we're also talking about, okay, so what's the big deal genetically modified? It's not a bad thing, right? But depends on how you're using it. So we look at row 7 seeds. That's genetically modified.
Yeah, I guess
in essence, it is. So that was the big argument that Calgene had said, was that they were manipulating one gene. Breeders are moving around all different kinds of genes. Hmm. So row 7 seeds are breeding and cross-pollinating things for flavor.
Right.
So it's not entirely a bad thing, but it depends on what it's used for, because Monsanto has this program, Roundup.
Yeah.
You know, so like with their corn and other plants, it basically, if an insect tries to eat the plant, they die.
Yeah.
And the plant is also resistant to pesticides.
Mm-hmm.
How can that be okay for us or animals to consume?
Yeah.
I don't get it. I mean, that to me does not make any sense. I mean, maybe, and this is me, you know, I could be proven wrong. Again, 100 years down the road, because of their work, we may turn into some sort of species that's impervious to certain diseases or something like that. But it doesn't make sense. It doesn't seem natural. I mean, to me, like, we need living organisms inside of us. And if you're consuming something that has the ability to kill an insect, how do you know that's not killing some beneficial bacteria inside your body?
Yeah, I'm sure it absolutely must be.
And like
totally must be.
Yeah, going back to, not to beat a dead horse here, but talking about how young we are as a species, we have no clue. We have no clue what these long-term effects are going to be.
Yeah.
And that's the scary part. I mean, when you look at, you know, a more modern tomato here, you know, you cut them open, these hothouse tomatoes. Tomatoes, in my opinion, are not meant. It's sort of the quintessential thing I go to all the time when it comes to eating seasonally and eating locally. They're not meant to be consumed 365 days a year. We've already touched upon this on one of the other podcasts.
Yeah.
You know, you cut into a tomato, you look at it. Look at it right now. If you guys, right now we're in early September, you know, in the Northeast. If you cut into a tomato now, really, like, obviously, like, maybe mid to late August, you cut into it and you can see the cross section. You want to see the outside of it to be like just this deep, beautiful, whatever color the tomato is, like an heirloom tomato. What makes an heirloom tomato so special is that it's never been, or at least in a very, very long period of time, has not been crossbred with any other, you know, genetically modified type of vegetable to make it grow more.
Yeah.
So with the heirloom tomato, it grows. It doesn't produce a ton of fruit, but it produces an amazing quality fruit.
Right.
There are a lot of tomatoes that are grown not with flavor in mind, but yield in mind.
Right.
And a lot of these tomatoes you're buying at the grocery store are also picked. I would say, I mean, 98% of tomatoes that are not in season, maybe even more, probably more than that, probably all of them, honestly, are picked when they're dead green. And then So what does that mean, right? So
I've seen this process. I saw it in Central America when I was like, I traveled through briefly and I was working on farms and stuff. And mostly I was working on organic farms, but we were toured through a conventional tomato plantation. And I saw them. I saw them being picked when they were green, dunked in these giant...
I'm sorry, can I interrupt you? But how are they picked, by hand or by machine?
In this case, it was by hand. A lot of workers out there. Also, like, hours before those workers went out, there were planes flying over, dropping pesticides down.
Yeah, amazing, right?
Anyway, so they get dunked in this water, so I guess that's rinsing them off. They get
pesticides.
Yeah, they get fed onto or caught up onto a conveyor belt. They get put through a chamber where they are fumigated with a slow and controlled ripening agent, ethylene or something like that.
Yep.
And then they go right into boxes, and then stacked, and then giant trucks come and take them away.
Yeah, it's amazing. I watched a farm out in the Midwest, and they were growing specifically processing tomatoes. So it was with Prego, the tomato sauce company. The video was sponsored by them. But this guy would grow, he said in 1 acre was over 8,000 plants planted. So they were able to plant them in these rows. So this big sort of cultivating machine would go over and just take them out, and there was a color-coding computer in there where it would register. If it wasn't ripe, it would spit them out. So, I mean, that's great for them, but also what a tremendous amount of waste, right?
Yeah.
But also they're just being just rifled into these huge containers, and they could fill 20 of these containers. And it looks like, you know, they're like probably a 20-foot long, probably by 10-foot wide container, 20 of them a day, which is a tremendous amount. But also the way in which they're be harvesting, you know that. I mean, a good tomato, like, so here's the deal. When you're getting those tomatoes the majority of the time in the grocery store, they're picked when they're not ripe. So that means the full flavor, the acidity, the sweetness is not there. So when you're eating something, it's like crispy water. So with these guys, you know, the processing facility is literally a quarter mile down the road, less than a mile down the road. So they're harvesting them, and they're just being bounced around all over the place. And then they're immediately getting processed either into peeled tomatoes, tomato sauce, whatever.
Yeah.
It's insane. But you know, I don't know. I mean, to me, I would just, I cannot stand eating tomatoes in the middle of December because there's just no flavor.
Yeah.
Because with anything like that, even corn, unless you have summer corn and it's ripened, and I mean, any good farmer will tell you, and anybody that's an avid like corn lover will also tell you that corn is the best the day that it's picked.
Yeah.
Immediately after that, it starts making the conversion from sugar to starch.
Mm-hmm.
So you get southern corn, it's like you bite into it, and it's like this idea, oh, you can grill it, you can add all different kinds of seasonings, butter, salt, the wood smoke on it.
Yeah.
It's still going to taste pasty and starchy.
Yeah, totally. There is one way I like to have tomatoes in the winter, if I can, preserved in some way.
I wish you didn't.
What?
I wish that you didn't, but go ahead.
Preserved, man, from the summer.
Yeah.
Take the bounty.
Agreed.
Can it, jar it, do whatever you want. I was looking at some of the early applications in North America of tomatoes to try to keep them around. This was in the antebellum South, you know, like before the Civil War.
Yes.
What have we got? Sun-dried cakes. They'd like take them, smash them up, form them into a cake, and leave them out in the sun.
So literally, it was just tomato smash.
Yeah.
Interesting. So what held them together? Because it wouldn't.
They
wouldn't
held themselves together.
Maybe they just. Okay, interesting.
There was also I didn't look at what this was, but but a dish called knuckled veal.
All right, that doesn't
sound pretty freaking awesome.
Yeah, and what was the story with that one?
I don't know what the heck knuckled veal is, but it was a form of using and preserving tomatoes so that they could be around in the wintertime.
So
must have been somehow like, I don't know, maybe using veal.
Shank
in some way. Yeah.
Braised, maybe with.
So like somehow, braised or allowing the marrow to come out and then the fat perhaps preserving it on top like an early sort of rillette, but with tomato. And veal? I don't know exactly.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, there's so many things to talk about preservation, but I think when you're talking about tomatoes, I think it makes sense to get really clear about what it actually is. So we've known for so long.
Is it a fruit? Is it a vegetable?
Yeah.
So, is it a vegetable?
So,
is it a fruit?
Yeah. So legally, in the United States, it's been listed as a vegetable for about 140 years by the law, smashed down by the Supreme Court.
Because that's important. That's important for the law to step in and like.
Well, yeah, decide. Of course, because they need to make their money.
Yeah.
So this whole situation stemmed from way back. There was I think it was the Tariff Act of 1883. I want to say if my notes are serving me, they're someplace here. But
there's not even words on there.
No, that's it's just all like upward. I mean, you should see it. It's like a child wrote it with crayon. But anyhow, yeah, the Tariff
doctor.
Act, and really, what the situation was that. Fruits, vegetables were taxed as they came in from shipments. Fruits were not.
Huh.
So this gentleman ended up bringing in a ton of tomatoes, and the government taxed him on it, and he went to court to fight it. He was like, what are you talking about? These are fruits. Because botanically speaking, They are a fruit. They're not a vegetable.
Yeah. Also interesting why vegetables were taxed and not fruits. Fruits would seem like they would be the more appealing thing and thus should be taxed since they would be coming in, they would be coming in more and more popular.
Depends. So, I mean, I think based off of the ultimate decision to tax them and label tomatoes as a vegetable to make money, you know, you got to think, who knows what was coming in? Was there potatoes coming in from different places? Were there this and that? I mean, onions, who knows what they were coming in? I mean, those are crops. I think people survive more on vegetables than they do on fruits. Mm.
And maybe there were already enough fruits in the country. They weren't taxed. Like there are peaches. There are apples.
Oranges.
There were oranges.
Right.
So maybe we were good on all that stuff. We weren't importing those things.
Yeah, but who knows? I mean, it could have been a huge crop in an off season or something with tomatoes, because tomatoes can grow here.
Yeah.
They've been proven to grow
right
here. So maybe this guy had like somehow a feed on something really special in the off season, and there are, and somebody, it's just amazing how, who knows what started it, right? To be a fly in the wall in a conversation like that, because somebody could have had a bad day or just needed to feel powerful. And they were like, you know what? We're going to tax you. Ultimately, the guy lost, and they labeled tomatoes as a vegetable. But the truth is, as we talked to, as I mentioned earlier, botanically speaking, they are a fruit. Mm. And if you can imagine 140 years of having them be thought of a specific way into a classification. So I've been doing a lot of research, inspired by this conversation, this podcast, and different things. And there's been a lot of sweet applications, which we'll get into.
Yeah.
But I've said, I've brought those up to a few people that aren't necessarily like elbow deep in the culinary industry like we are. And you mentioned something as a sweet application with a tomato, you get an emoji with a sick face, or like, really? That sounds kind of gross. Because I bet you, if you were to poll 90% of people and ask them, tomatoes, what do you think of? I would say 97% of them are going to say, oh, tomato sauce, or as you mentioned,
ketchup.
Yeah, which lives on, you know, basically every diner, you know, table or whatever. I mean, that's ubiquitous. It's everywhere. So
it is delicious.
Sure, absolutely. But when you're thinking about when you know tomato as that, that's something that goes on your hamburger, as ketchup goes on your fries. Do you want something that's going to go on your fries going to be on your dessert when you want your chocolate, you want your whipped cream, you want your vanilla? No. But you look at some of its botanical relatives. I mean, strawberries are in the same family as tomatoes.
Yeah.
Tomatillos, things like this. I mean, if you actually take some fresh tomatoes and throw them into a fruit salad, it's very good. We'll get into that later. But it's just interesting how the psychology, the part of it, if you're told something for generations and generations.
Open your mind, man. Just like expand.
Yeah. There's sweetness there. You know, if you get a really beautiful, sweet summer tomato, just close your eyes, bite into it, and see what you taste. You're going to get some acidity. You're going to get maybe some savoriness, some umami qualities like we were talking about. Salty. You're definitely going to get sweetness. So, you know, with a lot of things, you bite into a peach, they're sweet, they're delicious. You add a little extra sugar to that, you have a beautiful peach pie.
Mm-hmm.
Add a little extra sugar to tomatoes, and you got something special to
it. I mean, but peaches are also a little sour as well, like a tomato is.
Absolutely.
They've got the full profile.
It's interesting.
Of flavor.
So, yeah, I mean, it's, do you add, you know, then the question becomes, well, what about potatoes?
Yeah.
Do you add sugar to potatoes? Does that become a dessert? I don't know
about that. I don't know about that.
Yeah. I was listening to another chef, and he was talking
maybe like a sweet, you know, there's potato chips that are like the barbecue potato chips. They've got a lot of sugar on them.
They do.
Those are pretty good.
They do. I almost, but it's like, I don't know if it adds anything to the potato, because I feel like you have the
fat. It's just the medium. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, you have the fat that's like saturated into the chip, and then you have the sugar that's on top of it. So you get to the point, you start adding those things. You don't actually, I don't think it helps the potato. Yeah, exactly. I think it's a vessel for something.
Because the potato, it doesn't have a lot of sugars in it.
No.
It's got a lot of starch in that. So it's not, it feels like it wouldn't lend well to being prepared in a sweet sort of setting.
Yeah.
You know, like a lot of sweet setting things, they've got sugar.
Right.
So they can caramelize, they can get super dank and deep in that with that
dank.
Sweet and sour.
Dank.
That word dank I just threw
dank.
In there.
I don't know how it's applicable. Is that a culinary term? I mean, call me old fashioned.
You're old fashioned.
Is that how it is?
Yeah.
If I'm old fashioned, then shit, dude.
Absolutely.
You're way old, more than me.
Oh, here we go.
Yeah. So
you know what?
So now that we're talking,
you have better hair than me.
Well, came out looking like this. So I had nothing to do with it. Thank my mother. So let's talk about, since we're talking about these different dishes.
Yeah.
Obviously, we all know tomatoes, right? You think of, oh my God, I planted a ton of tomato plants because of COVID-19, and I'm going to have this amazing summer with all these tomatoes. Now you got all these tomatoes. What are you going to do with them? What are you going to make sauce with them? What else? Think about it. Think hard. Take a minute. You're thinking about tomato sauce. You're thinking about pizza. You're thinking about maybe salsa. And then what? I don't know. How much tomato sauce can you have?
Yeah. I'm thinking I'm sick of tomatoes already. What am I going to do with all these freaking tomatoes?
Yeah. And it's this whole anxiety-provoking thing. Because it's like I got this amazing abundance. So it's, again, but a perspective. Been looking at tomatoes for this many years as a vegetable.
Yeah.
So you're only looking at it as a vegetable.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be this case. This. So let's switch the perspective. We're going to introduce now this idea that it's a fruit. How else can you preserve it as a fruit?
Yeah, let's talk about that. Tomato jam.
So let's talk about, jam as an example.
Tomato chutney.
Tomato chutney, okay. So like, what do we got in there?
We got all kinds of sweet-ish sort of spices in there.
Mm-hmm.
Coriander.
Mm-hmm.
We've got star anise, maybe. Maybe we've got some other kind of anise thing.
Yeah,
we've got fennel.
The process. How do we start it? We start it with the raw tomatoes. We got them cut up. Then.
Okay. We got these raw tomatoes. We got them cut up.
Yeah.
Maybe we've peeled them and we've taken the seeds out. Maybe not. Because I say go for it.
Yeah, that's kind of precious, and that can be a lot, especially when you're looking at, 25, 30 pounds of tomatoes.
Don't worry about the tomatoes being bitter because you got a little bit of skin, you got a little bit of seeds in there. Let that ride. Bitter is a flavor. Let it be in there with everything. Let it be balanced in there. It's not going to take over and be this bitter, disgusting thing.
Some pompous chef teach you that.
Yeah.
Skins that make it bitter.
Yeah. Yeah, the whole process. The French back then with their tomato mother sauce.
Back then, still.
Yeah, and still, yeah. Scored, blanched, taken out, mm-hmm. deseeded. You end up with a third of the tomato that you started with.
Yeah, and a completely different flavor now because you blanched the outside of it.
Yeah, right.
Subjected it to hot temperatures.
Yeah, anyway, maybe start by sautéing some red onion, regular onion. Maybe there's something from your garden. Maybe you've preserved some garlic scapes, something like that. Anyway, I won't get too carried away with it. Start in with some kind of allium, maybe some garlic. Maybe you want to go in with some ginger, my friends. Mm. You put your tomato in. Maybe it's a thinner, wetter tomato, so you may consider some tomato paste then, just to thicken up. However, with the addition of a sweetener, sugar, or could be honey, could be maple syrup, you will find that you're able to thicken your chutney pretty well in that way too.
Yeah, then, you also might, when you're working your tomatoes, you said tomato paste, but maybe you don't use tomato paste, maybe you just reduce your tomatoes down to a pasty consistency.
Totally, so you just let it ride at that point. Bring it up to a boil, maybe add a little pinch of salt after you've added all that other stuff, turn it down and let it do its thing until it's about right.
Yeah.
And from there you've got a very beautiful, aromatic, sweet, savory, sour chutney. That's an awesome side for meats, for grilled vegetables, for those deep winter burgers.
Even like a richer fish, I would guess, like salmon too.
Totally.
Or if you really want to get wild, like a bluefish.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's versatile. And I think that, you make that. There's always this level of making something yourself.
Lamb, duck maybe even.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's
so
pretty versatile.
Good.
It's going to kick the hell out of any ketchup any day of the week. And even Baby Ray's, Sweet Baby Ray's barbecue sauce.
Yeah, those early ketchups too, I think. When you look at old recipes, I'm sure you've seen them. They had a lot more aromatic stuff to them. They were actually a lot more interesting than what they are now.
Yeah, a lot of high fructose corn syrup.
Yeah.
Nowadays, again, with the genetically modified corn.
Totally.
Yeah. A couple other things, too, just to realize. When you're storing, we're talking about preservation now. You can cook your tomatoes now.
You store them in the fridge, right?
All the time, 100%. No, you never, ever, ever. Well, there's only one reason you'd ever store your tomatoes in the fridge is because basically they come to a point where they're amazing, and then once they're ripe, they start to degrade after that.
Yeah,
so if you know you're not going to be able to get to them, and you start seeing some of them starting to split, you got the fruit flies happening. Also, where do fruit flies come from?
Fruit.
They just appear. They're like inside of it. Like, you know what I'm saying? It's so strange.
I always wonder if they like lay their eggs in there at some other point and then come out.
And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, we're starting to go rotten. But anyways, that's the only time you're ever going to put it in there because there is a specific aroma compound inside of tomatoes. Mm. What is it called? It's called, well, tomatoes are really high in linoleic acid. And that, which basically converts a compound called Z3-hexanal.
Z3-hexanal.
Yes, which gives tomatoes their taste. Mm. So cold actually diminishes the processing of turning in the linoleic acid to this specific aroma compound. And
So, but what happens to texture? Is texture sacrificed as a result of putting it in the fridge?
Yeah. So, yeah, absolutely. Because that all has to do with, again, ripening and then a sort of halting of it. And it just kind of, it puts in this weird stasis where it can't ripen and it has to sit. It's just not, it's not bred to do that because it wants to ultimately get mushy to decompose because really just the tomato husk, the shell itself, is just a vessel. Every single plant wants to spread its seed. Mm. So this whole thing is like a womb. So it gets to be super delicious.
It's exactly
super
what it
whatever.
Is. It's like a giant swollen ovary
exactly.
or something.
It's exactly right. That's how they, what they refer to these fruits as.
It's a
as
fruit.
Ovaries.
It grows like a freaking fruit.
Exactly. And so then what happens is it creates this beautiful thing and then it falls from the ground. It mushes down and the seeds either go into the ground or they try to attract other, you know, other animals like birds or whatever to come and pick it up and carry their seed around. Ultimately, all plants want to spread their seed. Mm-hmm. That's the story. Mm-hmm. So, again, Spark Notes, only ever put your tomato in the refrigerator if you can't get to it and you're going to use it. They've shown studies where 24 hours, up to 3 days, it can be okay. But anything after that, really, once it gets below 60 degrees, that includes out in the fields, why tomatoes had this like golden point, you know, where usually in August, where it's still hot at nighttime, when it's above 60s, where they're amazing.
Yeah.
Once they get below 60 degrees, that begins to inhibit that convergence of lycopene, or rather linoleic acid to that aroma compound. So, so there's more than salsa. There's more than tomatoes. Chutneys you were talking about. For me, Simeon's been sipping on tonight a little martini. So, again, you're thinking about tomatoes. Another nickname they had was Stinking Golden Apple. That was the other thing, which I found kind of funny because of the way how aromatic the plant was or is. And they're thinking to themselves, wow, okay, so it grows red, it stinks, it got this aroma, this thing cannot be edible. It's all these indicators why you should not consume it. So, with this specific drink here.
That is a delicious pickled green tomato.
So happy to hear that.
Oh my God, dude.
So what I did was I took the tomatoes, I mashed them up with a masher, combined equal parts vodka, and then cooked it sous vide underneath pressure.
Vodka.
So what you're doing is by putting it underneath vacuum, you are breaking the cell walls, you're pulling out the oxygen, and basically just getting
all that. Let them marry each other.
Yeah, absolutely pulling out all that beautiful tomato essence. Mm. Cook it at 160 degrees. So you're not really cooking it super hot to sort of change the flavor, but enough to help extract some of that flavor into the alcohol, ice bath it, strain it, put it into a vacuum press. And if you don't have a vacuum, I have a rotovap and I ran it through there. If you don't have a rotovap, let it just strain through cheesecloth. It's not going to be ultra clear, but it's going to be clear and you could still use it. And you have this delicious infusion. And then also we garnish it with these salty brined green tomatoes, sort of like an olive. So you want a nice salty tomato or a salty olive to go.
Oh man, that's so good. Quick geek question.
Yep.
How long does it need to be in the rotovap?
Basically, so what you're doing there is you're extracting everything. So the answer to that is until it's done.
Is it hours or what?
So depending on your vacuum pump that you have, I mean, for me, ultimately, it was probably about 2 hours it was in there for.
All right.
So I was looking to extract every single thing. Now, if you're doing something, if you're running alcohol yourself, you're only looking to pull out the alcohol vapors from it, and the rest of it is just water.
Yeah.
So it's different to distilling, but in this case, it's already been distilled. I'm working with the finished product with vodka, so I want everything that tomato has to offer.
Gotcha. Yeah, so, that's cool.
Other things too. You know, a green tomato sorbet. It's delicious. It's tart. It's sweet.
Also ingenious. Why not add a bunch of sugar to a tomato and make it into a sorbet?
Yeah.
Just like you would a peach. Just like you would passion fruit, just like you would strawberries, raspberries.
Exactly.
Same deal.
I had this concept of wanting to do, because right now the reason we're I'm talking about green tomatoes. Yeah, a green apple, right? So it's the same sort of interesting flavors you're getting out of it, sourness. The reason is because right now, tomatoes, they're still fruiting, but they don't have the daylight, the warmth to fully ripen. So a lot of people are going to have tons of green tomatoes to work with.
Yeah.
You can also, to speak of Simeon's chutney, you can make a green tomato chutney, which is also super delicious. I wanted to play around with this idea of making a red tomato ice cream, making a basil ice cream, and then making a maybe Parmesan.
The colors, man. Oh, there you go.
But so, but you think about, but I'm trying to think of like a classic Napoleon ice cream. You know, you go to the grocery store and you buy the Breyers or whatever, and you have those things. So imagine layering those. You make your first tomato that goes down, then you make your Parmesan, and then you make your basil. You know, so you have those three things, you cut it into a log and preserve or present it like that. So that's a great way of preserving the harvest as well.
Oh, yeah.
Nice. As I mentioned earlier, yeah, throw those tomatoes into a fruit salad. You know, if you got plums, something else that's similar in texture, they're going to work in there because they're going to add a different texture element. It's not going to be disgusting, believe me.
No.
No, I mean, tomato tartatin, which we've talked about before, I mean, just like a classic apple tartatin, it works really well.
Yeah.
And with the butter, the sugar, the acidity of those tomatoes, the puff pastry on top. Cook it in the cast iron. It'll rock your world.
Cast iron.
Yeah.
Oh,
all day long, baby. All day long.
I love it. I'm more of a simpleton. Simeon.
Simpleton Bittman.
Simpleton Bittman. I just like incredibly beautiful, delicious tomatoes. Heirloom always seems to do the trick. But there are, I just got a batch of locally grown plum tomatoes this past week. Dude, unbelievably delicious.
Really?
Absolutely amazing. I got them because I was going to make some sauce to put by. I haven't gotten to the sauce yet at work. We got 20 pounds of them. We're putting them in salads everywhere. We're putting them as little sides. We're just like quickly making like these awesome spreads with them and a little bit of basil and some olive oil and salt and pepper. You know, I got them from our boy Nick.
Yeah, from
I don't remember the farm though. Yeah. Sorry about that.
That's okay. I understand you don't care much about the product. You just care about getting it out. Go on, please. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
But yeah.
That's awesome.
I'm thinking slice them up. Yeah.
Yeah, plum tomatoes typically they're not meant to be served like that.
Totally. Roma's too, right now.
It's a sauce.
Freaking so good.
Yeah, so dense, low moisture.
Cut them thick, you know? Mm-hmm. And then they have this really great shape. Like when you slice them into a slice, a cross-section slice, maybe half inch long, you've got this beautiful, robust red round that looks awesome in the mix with other shaped heirloom tomatoes that are some are in wedges. Others are in rings. You can maybe go triangle with it. So that's what I've been all about, is very like salads presented with the tomato more or less raw, uncooked, but in different cool shapes on a bed of basil. Instead of just like sprinkling basil over the top, I'm just like, dude, get crazy with the basil.
Wow, really?
Just a bed of basil. So it's like sitting in there.
That's great. I mean, that's something you would never think about doing though in the winter, right?
No,
because there's nothing there.
You kind of can't. I suppose you could travel around the world and hitting the tomatoes while they're in season throughout the world,
and be
like nailing it.
Right.
That would take a lot of commitment. Yeah, I mean, mostly the reason why you won't have a tomato here in the winter is just because of the transport time and of all the methods employed to try to like preserve it from getting older or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, if you picked a tomato when it was ripe and tried to transport it from Florida, it'd be rotten. I mean, that's the thing. Anybody, I'm sure if you're growing them at home, you'll realize you pick a tomato. Like, you usually, if you don't, you got to pick it a little underripe on the vine at your house, because if you don't, then at least for me, the chipmunks, they go to town. They're like, oh, what's that? Oh, I love tomatoes.
Dude, especially
thank you
if you've
so
had the
much.
Same potato patch in the same spot or close by for a number of years.
Oh, yeah.
They learn where it is. The rabbits,
absolutely.
Too. They wait for it.
Yeah.
They'll like plan their survival, like their life around that.
They look forward to, they talk at Christmas time saying like, oh, yeah, and the tomatoes this year, I can't wait for them to plant those tomatoes next year. Because those are my favorite. I didn't know how much I love tomatoes. Each year they keep getting better.
So true, man.
Yeah, exactly.
But heirlooms in particular, I think it's good to pick them a little bit early.
For sure.
You can control the ripening of them in that way.
Yeah.
You just got to wait.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, as you know, you pick them, you put them on your counter when they're ripe. When they're ripe, you better eat them because a day or two later, they're going to go to rot. So you pick something. That's why heirloom tomatoes haven't been commercially... have not been commercially available for a long time because of that, because they're odd shapes, they're different colors, whatever. They don't pack perfectly. You know, you get a regular beefsteak tomato, you know exactly what size it's going to be, you know how many count it's going to be per flat, you know how long it's going to last, yada, 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 yada.
Yeah.
It's consistent every time.
Yeah.
So
that's so wild.
Yeah.
Science is amazing and also a monster.
It is. I mean, it can... you've mentioned before, you can't, you know, light a candle without casting a shadow. And it's unfortunate because a lot of this stuff, including, which we'll probably get into at a different time, the modern agricultural movement was industrialized. Agriculture was meant for a good thing. It was meant to feed the world. But it became a monster and capitalism, stepped in. And that was the big problem. You know, more, less.
Yeah.
More for less all the time.
Yeah.
So the takeaway, I think, for today, for you guys, is to challenge your conception of what a tomato is.
Yeah.
You know, understand that there's so much else to do than just make tomato sauce. And I also understand that we live in a world where you're completely just spoon-fed, force-fed even, you know, all different kinds of information. And there's so much, I mean, there's so many recipes out there that you can easily get to, but maybe because it's so easy to get to, you don't get to them. Because you'll think, oh, I'll get to them later. Meanwhile, you got 500 other things going on because it's so easy and your tomatoes are going rotten.
Yeah.
So love your tomatoes. Do something special and do something different. Yeah, do your tomato sauce. Absolutely. 100%. Put that up.
Yep.
But don't turn all of your tomatoes into tomato sauce. Experiment. Have fun with
them. Yeah.
You know, preserve them, put them up. I mean, one of the biggest things I'll leave you with for me that I love is, you know, even I love the combination of a richness with tomatoes. Summer tomatoes are so acidic, they're amazing. To complement that acidity is some richness. So I love cooking them with a lot of butter. And you can serve them basically a buttered tomato salad, and it's delicious. Salty, some fresh basil, boom, done. Maybe a little pinch of chili flakes, awesome.
Love it.
You can take that same situation, cook a lot of butter with salt, basil or thyme, garlic, whatever you have.
Yep.
And then throw your tomatoes in there to warm them up.
Yeah.
Pack those tomatoes into a mason jar. Absolutely cover them with the butter so nothing is showing. And you can preserve those tomatoes. And I will tell you, when we broke into June this year, I had my last jar of preserved tomatoes.
From last year.
Kept in the refrigerator. And you crack into them and you smell it. It's literally like smelling a beautiful summer tomato. Kind of smoky, kind of meaty, totally herbal. I mean, you capture the entire... you know, summer basil as well. So all of those compounds are fat soluble.
So
that
beautiful.
Is the way to keep them.
Yeah.
So just expand your horizons.
Yeah.
You got a little bit of period of time to do that now.
Yeah. And use them fresh, but try them fresh in combination with different ingredients that you're not used to using, but that makes sense. If you think about tomato as a fruit, that sort of could open up a new vocabulary for you. Like James mentioned, putting it in a fruit salad. How about something else that's growing around this time right now that tomatoes are at their most beautiful, which is wild grapes or Concord grapes.
Yes.
And grapes are starting to come in.
Speaking of aromatics.
Yeah, there you go.
You find those Concord grapes, you can smell them a mile away.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Imagine like a nicely sliced or a halve with a nice sharp paring knife and then de-seeded Concord grapes. In on top and around a tomato salad, like beautiful fresh tomatoes.
Yeah.
Maybe you've got some grape juice or wine, cook it down to a syrup. Maybe combine a little reduced cider in syrup in there as well.
Yeah, right, because that's coming out too. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
The seasoned apples, like the polar reds.
Yep. Exactly, man.
Yeah.
Sprinkle that over that salad?
What? Yeah, I could see how either way, either the cider or even the reduced down grape juice in this case would be like a great substitution for like balsamic. And also similar textures. I mean, I think that would be an amazing thing. So that's a great way to look at things. And again, sort of, I love that idea of bridging cuisine, I love the idea of bridging the seasons,
because
you sort of have that sort of baton handing off from summer to autumn, and there's that brief moment where it's like a couple weeks where those two things are in season together, and they grow Or they go great together. It's that phrase, what grows together goes together.
Goes together, man. Absolutely. I also think that our bodies, depending on where we're from, are used to getting that combination of vegetable and fruit that's in our region at each time of the year, at each season. So we're sort of predisposed to accepting and probably appreciating these flavor combinations as you know, as more of a thinking people that have developed cuisines, we've gone more in the direction of thinking about food in the context of the cuisine and which ingredients go together and which definitely don't. But probably on a deeper level, we have a much deeper acceptance about which seasonal ingredients are coming up right now and putting them together in a beautiful dish.
Absolutely. And also, just to sort of round out what you're saying there, is that all of this stuff wasn't like we were gifted at the beginning of the civilization a cookbook that said, put these things together.
Yeah.
It's by trial and error.
Probably a lot of poison.
Yeah, tons of that. I'm sure so many people died from trying things. But I don't. The point I was saying is a little less grim than that, is that try things together. Pair them together. You're never going to know. Maybe you like something that somebody else doesn't like. Don't let that deter you. Don't let somebody tell you, a tomato martini, tomato ice cream, that sounds disgusting. Try and see if you like it for yourself. You're never going to know.
This tomato martini, unbelievable, man. So good.
Clean, refreshing, thank
clean,
you.
Clean, refreshing, you. But like sour, as a martini usually is, because it's got that element from the olive and from brine, if you like it dirty. Ah, it's just like, it makes total sense.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. It's a great change in perspective and a great celebration, sort of like, you know, a toast to a good tomato season.
Yeah, so,
I think that. Yeah, I think that's probably going to do it for us now here. So as always, if you guys enjoyed this content, which I hope you did, please give us a follow at Figuratively Feasting on Instagram.
Yep.
Drop us an email at figurativelyfeasting@gmail.com for questions, concerns, feedback. I mean, we love, what are you interested in? Drop us a line. Tell us what's up.
Yeah, and I would love to continue the conversation about tomatoes and about recipes around the world. If you are in a country that's really far away from us right now and have been inspired by tomatoes, please tell us about some of your ideas, some of the things you cook with, some of the things you grew up cooking that involve tomatoes. Like, I reached out to some folks, like some Indonesians and some Chinese cats, and they were stoked to send me so many different recipes and ideas, things that they grew up with that involved the tomato. Like, it's near and dear to our hearts, this beautiful fruit, vegetable, mostly pretty much fruit thing.
That I think, frankly, we take for granted on a daily basis. It is everywhere. It surrounds us. And I think, speaking for myself, I had a lot of fun with this project because it just enlightens you, and it helps you have a much more healthy respect for this thing.
Yeah.
It deepens the knowledge, and we love sharing knowledge. We love learning new things.
Absolutely.
So let us know.
Yes.
So, until next time, gang, thank you so much. We'll see you later.
Bye-bye.